Well, what a week it's been in international politics. President Donald Trump's travel ban on the citizens of seven Muslim-majority countries has dominated headlines around the globe, and it's anyone's guess what the Trump White House is likely to announce next. With me to discuss the geopolitical implications of the Donald Trump presidency from our Wellington studio, Nagar Patel, a senior lecturer at Massey University's Centre for Defence and Security Studies and Canadian-born economist head of research at the New Zealand Initiative, Eric Crampton. Kia ora, Nagar, Eric.
Good morning.
And with me in Auckland, Paul Buchanan, a former intelligence analyst for the US government and regular commentator on international affairs. Paul, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Well, starting with you first, Paul, the so-called travel ban targets the very same seven countries that were first identified by the Obama administration for increased scrutiny. Is the reaction to Trump's move a bit overblown?
No, the reaction, I mean, it's divided, of course. That is, those who support him, I think it's well justified. Even if it was poorly thought out and poorly rolled out, the rest of us think that it's an outrage. And the thing is, it violates basic conventions on refugees, where you cannot discriminate based on ethnicity, nationality, or religion. And so, as well as, you know, constitutional guarantees in the United States. So there's a problem there. And, of course, the litigation that we've seen right from the onset gives you an indication that this is going to roll through the courts. I have a feeling that it'll be fast-tracked on appeal straight to the Supreme Court. But therein lies the problem. There's eight justices, not nine. And we're pending confirmation on Trump's nominee. This could turn into a major constitutional crisis.
And Eric, as Paul has initiated there, a federal judge in Seattle temporarily lifted the ban on all refugees and visa holders from the seven Muslim countries. And the White House called that an outrageous ruling and pledged to restore as soon as possible the president's lawful and appropriate order, quote unquote. The dissent coming from various quarters is quite extraordinary, isn't it, Eric?
Oh, it's been great to see the pushback on this one, and especially from within the United States. Now, some of that will be polarizing itself because a lot of Americans who support Trump don't quite realize the extent of the ruling, that it isn't just a couple of hundred people, that it's affecting potentially hundreds of thousands, and many of them who have had green cards in America for a long time and have lived there for decades, all of their lives are based there, their families are there, and then they try and come home and they get blocked at the border. If that reality gets through to people, they might start reassessing the desirability of that ban.
Well, Nagar, you're an Iranian Kiwi dual citizen. What was your initial response to the ban, and how have people in Iran, as you know, responded to it?
It is very interesting to see the responses of different communities. I look at it from an academic perspective, but I've noticed that it has created constitutional questions for other countries such as New Zealand, Canada, and many of them actually don't know how to deal with this dual jurisdictions for their citizens who have dual citizenship from other countries. Of course, Iranian community have played a significant role in this resistance, both in the United States and in different countries. But the law is still not clear, so many of them are stranded. And even they have a big demonstration now in LAX airport in order to kind of move beyond this law. So hopefully this standoff helps.
And as an academic yourself, Rain, will it affect you personally in any way?
I think it is very interesting for me as a person who works on women issues particularly, because in the text, President Trump particularly mentioned that his order is for protecting women, particularly because he views women have been treated very badly, according to him, in Islam. So he views this as a part of protecting women, which created quite a lot of outrageous responses from different feminist movements, particularly who are very outraged by Donald Trump's behavior towards women during the campaign, but also the pro-choice policies that he have been passing since he has taken the office.
Eric, you wrote last year that while Trump would be a terrible president, he would at least be constitutionally constrained, and that he would face difficulty in Congress. Have you had to revise your thinking?
A little bit. That was about a year ago. Yeah. So during the primaries, the Republican establishment seemed to deeply loathe Donald Trump. And it was at a visceral level. It wasn't just his policies. It was his whole way of being that it just wasn't part of the Republican elite consensus on how people should behave in politics. And I thought that would help reinforce the other constitutional constraints in place. So normally, it's not a presidential system is very different from a parliamentary one. He would have to get Congress on side, and he would need he would have a very difficult time implementing his agenda other than executive orders through the administration without the support of Congress. And even on those sides, if Congress were against him, they'd have other ways to punish him. And then, of course, the courts as a final check. Now, I was pretty dismayed last week when he was telling the marshals not to follow the court's rulings, not to enforce the court's restrictions on the executive orders, but it's heartening to see that the Washington court judges, or the Washington state's judges ruling nationwide is being enforced. Now that'll get appealed, and I'm not a lawyer. I think from what I've seen on it from lawyers, the unconstitutionality of the ban on green card holders coming back is pretty sound. The rest of it, we've built a system in the U.S. where the president has a lot of discretion. There haven't been a lot of checks and balances because the party that's in charge always likes being able to do things, or checks on the executive through the administrative agencies, I mean. Now, the big test then for the Republicans is whether they're going to be able to bat back the president's agenda or whether they are sufficiently worried about their own career concerns that they'd be reluctant. So nobody really wants to be the first mover, say, in an impeachment that fails because your career is over as a Republican if you do that. So I'm more pessimistic than I was last year, but this latest ruling has been pretty good.
Right. What's your thoughts on what Eric said there, Paul?
Well, Eric actually put his finger on the heart of the issue, which is the presidential system. And I'll put my former academic hat on because I do write about comparative politics. The perils of presidentialism is a phrase used by the political scientist Juan Lintz. And it refers to the fact that a lot of what a president's behavior what it is about is actually custom and practice. It's not inscribed in law. So the checks and balances are actually much more fragile in a presidential system than in a parliamentary system.
Right.
And you need a major crisis to remove a president who's misbehaving. You see, it's always been assumed that when someone goes into the Oval Office, the weight of history, the institutional weight as well, serves like a sort of straitjacket on the president, you know, prevents him from doing, you know, really abusing his power. But it assumes that the individual who enters the Oval Office puts his own interests below that of the nation as a whole, that, as Eric said, he's going to look to compromise. He's not going to try to get along with Congress. And we have an individual now who doesn't really care. And again, as Eric mentioned, he went and tried to circumvent the first court order that stayed the ban. Now, this is contempt of court. And the issue here is the politicians and the GOP politicians, they clearly have done a Faustian bargain in that they're going to let Trump pursue his agenda so long as he supports their legislative agenda, which includes repealing Roe versus Wade, obviously, you know, repealing the Affordable Health Care Act and tax reform, among many other things. I think that a lot of them believe that if they let Trump be Trump, that'll be the rope that he hangs himself with. But they're going to wait until there's blood in the water before they make any move against him, and a lot of damage can be done before that. Now, I'll just say one other thing, and it's yet to be seen if this will occur. It appeared in the beginning that all of this flurry of executive orders, 20 in 10 days, was designed, it was as if he was throwing a sop to his base. It was the red meat thrown to his supporters, and he never really expected that these executive orders would survive the test of legal scrutiny. And that still may be the case, but as the White House has responded to the legal challenges, it appears that maybe he or his advisors actually believe they can make some of this stick, if for no other reason that they will be able to circumvent the normal checks and balances. And quite frankly, if they continue to do so, they remain in contempt of court. That could bring a constitutional crisis between the judiciary and the executive.
Nagar, back here at home, Bill English has come into a heap of criticism for not responding more forcefully to the travel ban. Extreme vetting, as Spicer says. Is that fair? And what, if anything, would speaking out forcefully achieve?
Can I just kind of connect it with the previous question you were asking? The international consequences of changes in politics in the United States has significant impact in international relations, and particularly creates doubtful positions for smaller states who have very extensive economic connections with the United States, but also are very much concerned about the ideas of their citizens. Now, a couple of things that he has done is that he has positioned himself, Trump, at the top of the system and undermined democratic values. That created problems for the United Kingdom, as you know, as also for many other prime ministers who came out and had a criticism about this. But also what I see was became an issue in New Zealand is that our Prime Minister didn't have quite a clear idea about this. This ban was forced in 2016 at the first time, not the eradication of visas, but the fact that these dual citizens had to apply for the visa. So this means that at that basic level, our Ministry of Foreign Affairs needed to have a communication with civil society and inform the citizens with dual citizenship about these changes.
What do you think of that, Eric? And I think you wrote a thought piece, didn't you, suggesting that America's loss could be New Zealand's gain?
Yeah. It would always be difficult for a New Zealand prime minister to come out excoriating an American president, but actions are a little bit more influential anyway. We could pretty easily have established a new skilled migrant category or an expansion to current intake, saying that anybody in America on something like an H-1B visa. So these are some of the most skilled migrants in America. You have to be earning at least $60,000 a year to be granted an H-1B, and they're mostly working in the tech sector. These are the kinds of people New Zealand has always been trying to target through its skilled immigration program. Simply announcing that, like 5,000 people, pick a number, that are in America on H-1B visas from the affected countries would be welcome to just swap it over for a New Zealand work visa, for a two-year work visa. Similarly, there's been a lot of pressure on the government to increase the refugee quota. I think the best way of doing that is through adoption of something like the Canadian sponsorship regime, where the bulk of the cost of accommodating new migrants and helping them settle is borne by private individuals who want to help and to do good. Announcing an expansion to the trial of the Canadian system that we're currently running here, there's about 25 that are coming in and Anglican Social Services are helping them out. Expanding that for the refugees with whom America has broken faith, that have already gone through some of the most rigorous screening practices in the world and then aren't allowed to travel. Letting Kiwis who want to help sponsor them to come here. Again, you don't have to come out trashing the American president, say this is something that we can do to help. And then it puts onus back on civil society here to front up. There's been a lot of talk about how much we want to help. Letting Kiwis who want to help actually go about doing it rather than just yelling at the government would be such an improvement.
Yeah, it could be an interesting idea. Your thoughts on that? Keen to hear your views. Sunday at rnz.co.nz. Text 2101. I'm with Eric Crampton, Nagar Pato, and Paul Buchanan this morning, talking about the events of the last week and a lot of them regarding Trump, US, and our reaction. And Paul, an interesting aspect for me is this guy, Steve Bannon. former Breitbart newshead who's now playing a key role in the Trump White House. And you've been concerned around the type of clearance he's been able to achieve now being part of the National Security Council. But first, on a personal note, you had to go through several levels of clearance yourself to get to a high security. What sort of background checks do you have to go through? I think you mentioned it took a year for you.
Yeah, it depending on how high you go, and I had a fairly high clearance. What they do is they run background checks that include interviewing, in my case, my my undergraduate friends, and they can be devious. They'll start talking about other friends, you know, mutual friends, and then eventually get around to Paul Buchanan. But they went back to people who knew me in high school, and that high school happened to be located in Buenos Aires, Argentina. I had the polygraph test. I had drug tests. They interviewed my ex-wife. She didn't have much good to say about me, but apparently it wasn't security related. My neighbors, I was living on a ranch at the time, and so there were these old ranchers that would get visits by people in black cars. And it took an FBI background check. So all in all, before I took the job that required this clearance, it took about a year. And I guess the problem for me with Bannon is that, as far as anyone can tell, he has not undergone anything of the sort. And the trouble there is that, given his background, you know, I'm not going to be polite and call it alt-right, this neo-fascist view of his. You know, he consorts with neo-Nazis, both in the United States and Europe and in Russia. He talks to the Russians regularly. And so it puts the people who in the national security apparatus who have to make decisions and have to inform the president and his advisors about very sensitive material, it puts them in a terrible position, because you can't be sure who Bannon is talking to. And the fact that he's been appointed to the National Security Council and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has been demoted, as well as the director of national intelligence, is bad for two reasons. One is that it brings a political operative in what is normally an apolitical setting. Again, you know, the highest policymaking body when it comes to national security in the United States is the NSC. He's now in there wearing his hat as a political operative. And then again, he's in there. You know, I won't say that he's a mole, but again, he consorts with unsavory types, both domestic and foreign, without that clearance. I don't think he would survive a security vetting such as the one I went through. I don't think they would let him anywhere near sensitive information. But we have to remember, and part of the reason I'm very concerned is that elected officials are not security vetted. This was always a problem when we went up to the Hill behind closed doors to talk to the intelligence committees on both sides, because here we are, you know, about to disclose some sensitive stuff, and we're talking to Congress people who have skeletons in their closet, because we're told about all that before we go up to talk to them. And, you know, we find ourselves being very creative storytellers to try to avoid telling them the exact details of the sensitive stuff, because we know that they may be compromised. Well, Bannon is the worst nightmare for the intelligence community. And I don't know, you know, short of removing him from the NSC and putting him through the security vetting process, I don't see this as how could I put it? Any good coming from this?
Yeah. Coming up to the headlines, but just final thoughts, Nagar Paul. He's also said previously he thinks there'll be a war, Steve Bannon, between China and the US in the South China Sea. Just finally, both of you, Nagar and Eric, rather, what are the implications for our region? Anything else to think about?
We should be pursuing free trade agreements with the other countries in the TPP, trying to build stronger links that way. Mexico's already approached looking for a free trade agreement. We should be strengthening our trade links with China. We've got a free trade agreement there. America's natural allies in the Pacific should be trying to get broader integration within the Pacific to try and discourage America from doing bad things there.
Can I also add that whatever the Trump administration has done, one thing that has done is that they have united various civil society groups across the globe, and Women's March was very important and significant. And we actually have a voice about humanitarian issues, whether at the platforms like United Nations Security Council or at other platforms across the globe. And I think we should actually take a position to play that role.
Nagar Pato, Senior Lecturer at Massey University's Centre for Defence and Security Studies. Eric Crampton from the New Zealand Initiative and Geopolitical Analyst Paul Buchanan. Thank you all for your time this morning. Really appreciate it.